This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Science Show in Northern Scotland.
Have you come across anyone in your time up here near Loch Ness who actually thinks he or she has seen the monster?
Yes, my wife, she actually filmed something very strange on the surface of the loch, and it is difficult to explain, and she's thoroughly convinced that what she saw was the Loch Ness Monster.
Hello, I'm Robin Williams. But the much bigger story up there is trees, putting back native forests, as we'll hear. Then we'll learn about new fuels for faster jets, offering cheaper travel, and finally meet two women who head two of the great Royal Societies, one in New South Wales, just turned 200, the other, the very first, in London. But we begin with Jeremy Leggett, former professor at Imperial College and Oxford, with his massive project in a world-famous setting.
Highlands Rewilding is a new type of company. It's a mass ownership company, and it's going to do its level best to accelerate nature recovery in the Highlands of Scotland so as to contribute to repair of climate meltdown and biodiversity collapse.
That's some remit, isn't it? Jeremy Leggett, could you place us? Where are we? I know down below is Loch Ness, but Loch Ness, much to my surprise, is very, very long. So where are we?
We're halfway along Loch Ness, about 16 miles from a fairly big city, Inverness, the capital of the Highlands of Scotland. And despite the proximity to that city, we're in a really wild place. There's 1,200 acres on this estate that we're managing, and not many footpaths, and there's a lot of genuine wildland in our mixed habitats of native woodlands, peatlands, pasture, heathland, and coniferous plantations.
How long is Loch Ness? Because I thought it was like a sort of big lake, but it isn't.
Yes, it's a huge freshwater lake. I think it's about 50 miles long, approximately. And it's a very, very impressive body of water indeed.
There's a rumour you own half of it.
Well, temporary custodianship of them, and in the estate papers it does say that we own the lock out to the midpoint, but I don't know, I think we probably need a navy to enforce any kind of sense of ownership.
If it's the deepest part, is that where Nessie might be? Is that where the monster might hide?
That's what various locals have pointed out to me. If we own the deepest part of, or half of the deepest part of Loch Ness, then possibly we own the Loch Ness monster.
Which would be quite amusing if it were true, but still, looking at the huge estate, we've got a wonderful garden we're sitting on, which goes down the hill, and then range after range of hillside, mountains and so on, all covered in trees. The one thing that's really surprising about what you're doing is you're removing many of the trees so as to achieve what?
Well, helping with climate and biodiversity, and it's really interesting. I set out on this exercise, as you know, as a long-term climate campaigner with no particular expertise. So I spent the first year conferring with all and sundry, all the experts I could attract to come here, and there were a good few. And they all disagreed with each other on how you should go about nature recovery. But the one thing that they all agreed on was get rid of the monoculture plantations. They should never have been planted the way they were, particularly on the peatland. Very bad for biodiversity and not very good for carbon either. So that's what we've done. We've acted on that. And if someone had said to me, as a long-term environmentalist, you'll end up cutting down thousands of trees, I'd have said a couple of years ago, you must be balmy. But that's exactly what's happened.
Are those pines?
Yes, there's spruce trees, and the Sitka spruce is the great enemy of the ecologists. I show ecologists around this place, and they pluck the Sitka spruce saplings out of the ground where they've regenerated.
And I suppose what you're trying to do is re-establish what was here. But the problem is that if you're trying to have an effect on carbon emissions and such like, pine trees grow fairly quickly, I presume, and your replacement will take a few years to achieve?
Yes, you have to put your faith in the long-term system, and there's very good science to show that the broadleaf, a mixture of native species, does take down more carbon over the lifetime of the tree. And so that's one of the reasons you go for it. Another reason is that in the mix of native species, you have resilience to the kind of pests we're going to see spreading in the warming world. And the other thing we've noticed, quite remarkable this, we're having many more windstorms now, severe ones. We had 3 named storms in a week earlier this year as a result of climate change. And they knock the conifers over like soldiers being mown down on the Somme. And the broadleafs, you know, they take a bit of a battering, but they do much, much better.
Even broadleafs like oak?
Yes, and we have a very rare stretch of the oak woodland down on the lower Loch Ness slope that I take tree ecologists into that place, and they start swooning at how wonderful it is. And some of them think it's, you know, a strip of temperate Atlantic rainforest, of which there's very little left in the United Kingdom. And so it's a special duty, not just to enhance biodiversity, as we're trying to do in various ways, but to protect what we've got, because it's become so vanishingly rare. And earlier you said that you can see trees going off into the distance, but actually the far range of hills is as bald as a coot. And that's because of sheep and human practices, desperation to shoot deer. And that has denuded those mountains of pretty much everything.
When you explore this area, as I've tried to briefly in my quick visit, you see the variety of landscape, and it includes peat bogs. In other words, where you don't have trees necessarily established, you've got depth of peat which goes down meters. Are they lasting, or are they too in danger?
Well, they're in danger. They can dry out and they can burn. And most of Scotland's peat, of which there's a vast amount, is in a poor condition. We have an area, a very large peat bog, but it's only 13% of the area of the estate. But we've measured the depth of the peat. It's up to 4 metres thick. And that means there's up to 10 times more carbon in that peat than there is in all these woodlands. 70% of the estate covered in varied woodlands. And the other thing we've discovered is that it's emitting so much carbon dioxide that is actually cancelling out the amount that's coming down into the trees. So this at first pass seems like terrifically bad news, but it is actually, there's a glass half full approach to that, which is that actually you can fix it fairly easily. What you have to do is cut down the conifer plantations that should never have been put on the peat, number one. And number two, you block the drainage channels. You do everything you can to keep water in the peat area so that the sphagnum mosses can grow and prosper, and that's what takes the carbon down out of the atmosphere.
What is peat actually?
Well, it's just a long accumulation of organic matter. It's very rich in carbon that comes from the accumulation of the mosses that make the surface of the peat bog over time. And 4 metres, that is roughly 4,000 years worth of peat accumulation since the ice retreated from Scotland.
Plenty of peat in Australia, and tragically, some of it sometimes is on fire, with fires lasting years. Incredible, isn't it?
Yes, and that's my big fear as I sit here in something approaching paradise, looking out at these woodlands and with the peatlands, although they're pretty degraded, they're rather special when the heather comes out in August. And I worry that at some point, if we don't really start turning the tide on climate change, I or my descendants are going to be watching this stuff burn.
Fortunately, you have assistance from science, and you've got a team coming soon from Oxford. It's postdocs, is it?
Yeah, and full professors. It's very exciting because it's the entire university has decided that they're going to set up a centre on nature recovery. All the multiple departments that you would think ought to be interested in this are interested. And it's a 10-year programme, massively funded by the Leverholm Trust. And they're going to be deploying not just the academics, but postdocs as well, joining the team that I've been lucky enough to attract here anyway, which is led by two world-class mid-career scientists with a chief data scientist who's joining them at the end of the month, who basically ran much of the data analysis for the British Civil Service. She got an OBE for that, Kathy Atkinson, and she's decided to abscond to help us crunch our numbers in nature recovery in Scotland, because we're hoping not just to perform very well ourselves on our two estates, but help other landowners to change their land management practices so that we can scale nature recovery.
All happening around Loch Ness, and it's a long, long way, of course, from the whole of Australia, but is what you are doing an example of what could be done in terms of examination of biodiversity and restoration, rewilding, if you like, to some extent, that could be done anywhere?
Yes, it is part of what has to happen globally. Obviously, it will vary in its approaches to land management in different land types, but that's a universal challenge that we all have. And the other aspect, of course, is the aspect of community. We'll never beat these existential threats unless we have full engagement, the full fighting power of local communities. And we're trying very hard to do that in Scotland. And that applies whether you're talking about the Highlands of Scotland, the Amazonian rainforest, or the Australian outback.
Dr. Jeremy Leggett, once of solar fame, now in the Highlands rewilding. His favourite trees are those native oaks he mentioned. And the global challenge is vast, as Rhys Halter reports from California.
Deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon during the first half of 2022 eclipsed all records. From January to June, 4,000 square kilometres of irreplaceable tropical forest, teeming with life, were razed. It's the equivalent area of rainforest destroyed to that of four times the size of New York City. What's even more startling is that this accelerated looting in the Amazon took place during the rainy season. Historically, deforestation is higher in the drier second half of the year, when it's easier to access remote areas on unpaved roads. The area leveled in the first half of 2022 is 80% larger than the same period in 2018. As if that stat wasn't stark enough, try this on 2,562 Amazon rainforest fires hit a new record for the month of June. The Amazon rainforest is Mother Earth's largest remaining tropical rainforest. Each heavenly ton of living wood represents 1,000 tons of water that the tree has filtered and released into the sky. The Amazon rainforest makes rivers in the sky that irrigate the breadbaskets of Argentina, the U.S. Midwest, and northern Mexico, feeding 500 million people. Ladies and gentlemen, the harsh reality is that today's children face a worsening environment with fewer animals and a more hostile climate each and every year. We absolutely need a living, breathing, sopping Amazon rainforest, an indispensable biological jewel. That's why 400 indigenous nations have come together to create a holistic plan for a sacred corridor of life from the Andes to the Atlantic, 203 million hectares. It's a first step safeguarding the existence of planetary life. Since there's one new billionaire every 30 hours, what if the 2,000 wealthiest people came together and bought the remaining living Amazon rainforest, gifting the protected refuge to divine earthly life? Why not? For the Science Show, from the tallest trees on the face of the earth, Northern California's redwoods, I'm Rhys Halter.
Who got his PhD in forestry in Melbourne. Is he right? Well, here's a thought from the late James Lovelock.
To me, clearance of the tropical forest is by far the most damaging thing that we're doing to the earth and to people. You see, they're talked about in connection with the CO2. This I see as a relatively unimportant part of their function. They might have drugs in some trees that would cure cancer. They may well do, but this isn't the point. The real point about the tropical forests is those trees evaporate vast quantities of water and give off gases that assist the formation of clouds above them. And the clouds that form above them bring the rain that sustains the forests, but at the same time reflect a vast amount of heat away from the earth. In other words, they're part of the planetary refrigerator. If you take down the trees, the clouds go, and the place becomes a desert. The two are inextricably linked together. Now, at the present rate of clearance, they're taking out an area equal to Britain every year, and simple calculation shows that by the year 2000, 70% of all the humid tropical forests will be gone. Now, we know from ecology that if you remove 70% of an ecosystem of that kind, the rest collapses because it can no longer sustain its climate and goes to desert anyway. So soon in the next century, if we go on clearing at the present rate, those regions will become desert or scrub, and yet there's a billion people living there, and so that quite suddenly there'll be a billion people facing conditions just like the Sahel, the kind of thing that Bob Geldof, you remember, did that Band-Aid program on. And it's that I think is by far the most important environmental issue affecting both the planet and people.
The late Jim Lovelock. Yes, the warnings go back decades. And our final thoughts on trees come from a professor of plant physiology at the University of Tasmania. He was formerly at Harvard. And Tim Brodribb also has some startling ideas about our trees. You've just come out of the field and packed up your gear. What were you doing there?
We are trying to sense the change in water content in plants as they shrink and swell during the day. So we're trying to get a record of how stressed plants are in real time, which seems like a really simple thing to do, but actually it becomes very complicated when plants are being very uncommunicative, as they tend to be.
Don't they just wilt?
Well, no, most of the trees don't really wilt, particularly the Australian ones. The leaves are so tough. Even if they were inclined to wilt, they just hang there. So you can't really get a useful indication of how stressed things are in the forest by whether they're wilting. And wilting is not something you can plot on a graph and say this is a certain level of stress and therefore the plant is this far from dying. Once a thing starts to wilt, yes, it could probably do with a bit more water, but we want to be able to say this plant is 25 days from self-destruction, and that requires some quite complicated calculations.
So you're looking into the plant. Are you actually going inside it and picturing it that way?
Yes. So one of the things that we're looking at is there is a very catastrophic change that happens in a plant when it becomes stressed, and this is particularly when it's drought stressed. The water that's flowing in the veins of the plant will transition from being liquid, which works very well, to being gas. Essentially, the vascular system begins to boil, which is a weird concept. If you take water at room temperature and you expose it to a vacuum, it boils. And so these trees are sucking water very, very hard out of the soil. And in doing so, they're creating a vascular system that's very unstable. And so we're interested in looking at that rapid transition from when the plant is functioning. It's got liquid water in its veins and it's happy. A very rapid state transition when it goes to, it's like it's blood boiling and very quickly transitions to mortality. So that's what we're trying to capture.
Wow. And which trees are you looking at? Which plants are you looking at?
Almost all of them will have a vascular system and they all employ the same mechanism to get water out of the soil. It's something people have debated for hundreds of years. You know, how does the plant get water out of the soil? And the answer is, it's simple, you know, it just sucks it out of the soil. But in doing so, it creates this very, very unstable conditions where it can go from functioning well to sort of exploding on the spot and transitioning to death. Yeah, we've looked at mosses, we've looked at ferns and conifers, and we've probably represented just about every major plant group that there is on Earth so far.
Extraordinary, because I remember the great puzzle in exams. I'm seeing a tree over there. We're sitting in the museum across the courtyard, this huge tree, and you've got a column of water really going up the xylem, as it's called, right to the top there. It's, you know, twice the size of a normal building, and somehow that needs to stay intact. and you sucking it up, as you say. The question was, how do you get it to the top of trees? Is there an answer to that?
Yeah, there is. But 99% of people would get it wrong, because we talk about suction, but if you suck, you can only suck water up 10 metres. That's the absolute limit to how far a vacuum will suck water up. But plants are able to suck much, much harder. You know, they use a different property of water, the capillary action, to pull water up. And using that doesn't cost any energy for them. So the concept that they're pumping water is completely wrong. They're still sucking, but because they're using this property of water, capillarity, really they could suck water a kilometre into the sky if they felt like it. But the problem is that the water in that state would be so unstable, they wouldn't be able to hold that in a liquid state. And this is the problem. Plants have been really clever, because they've found a way to move tons of water over huge distances without costing any energy. That's great. But at the point that that system fails, the point where it starts to break is catastrophic, so that there's this very dramatic transition from a liquid vascular system to the system where your blood's boiled, everything's blocked, and there's only one thing you're going to do, which is to die. So yes, it's a good idea, as long as everything goes well.
Is it a general story?
It's completely general, yeah. But what's confusing is that plants do pump water quite well. So if you go and look at your tomatoes first thing in the morning, on a humid morning, they'll be pumping water out of the leaves. There'll be drips on the tips of the leaves, because the roots do pump water. But it's thousands of times less water than they need to function during the day. So every one of them has to use this same system that's evolved, obviously, a very long time ago.
Well, now you've got some clue as to what's going on there. What you can do with this insight?
It's a very useful thing to know how stressed a plant is. And we've recently devised, by using these optical techniques of visualising how much tension is in the xylem, how hard the plants are sucking, we can work out how much water they're using, how stressed they are. And so we can easily say to people, this is exactly the moment you need to water your plant. And in fact, we have a very interesting experiment going at the moment, where we have a plant, we have a sensor on it that's telling it its stress level, and that sensor can activate an irrigation stream for the plant. So the plant can decide when it wants some water. And so we've got this lovely system where the plant's just sitting there watering itself when it feels like it. So this is all pretty recent developments, but we're very excited that that's going to be really useful for controlling irrigation, because we want to know what the plant feels. The current techniques are to really measure the soil, and the soil is not the plant. The plant puts its roots into the soil and gets water from different parts of the soil, but it's very hard to understand what the plant wants and how stressed the plant is by sensing the soil. We move to sensing the plant, and I think there's some very interesting problems that we can solve with that.
Do you ever get told off, Tim, for saying plants feel and plants want, or various ways of using language on that?
Yes, I have been told off, but I think that the people telling me off aren't thinking clearly enough about the question, really, because plants do feel. I don't think that there's any ambiguity about whether plants know what's going on. Plants are very sensitive organisms. They have as many sensory networks as we do. They know when they're being hurt. And for us, pain is an evolved process to tell us when our tissues are being damaged, and so we can avoid stress. Plants have exactly the same response pathway. They sense damage, they sense stress.
Isn't it more mechanical?
No. Well, for example, the water stress. Water stress is being measured by basically the salt concentrations in the cells largely. There is electrical signaling that responds to pH. I mean, the plant knows obviously what the light conditions are like. It can measure the amount of carbon dioxide. They're much more clever than we are in the sense that, you know, they're very good at sensing carbon dioxide and a number of other airborne chemicals. They're very sensitive organisms, very much beyond mechanical sensing, the chemical sensing. These are very sensitive creatures that are feeling in a very analogous way to the way we are. You can tell me off, but I...
Creature indeed, yes.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's one of the challenges I see. You know, plants are absolutely our best friends on Earth. They give us absolutely everything. And people are inclined to consider them really not as creatures, barely as living organisms, you know, that I don't think there's a lot of respect for plants. And I think it's to our peril to not have a deep respect and a deep understanding of plants, because they are everything for us and they are our best friends on Earth. You know,
we couldn't live without them.
And nothing on Earth could live without them. That's the point. Everything we eat is either fed directly by us from plants, or every animal that we eat is fed on plants. I'm not sure whether people quite understand that every piece of solid carbon that we depend upon comes from that process of photosynthesis. So we are standing on a platform that's made by plants, and if we don't look after them, we're going to fall into a heap very quickly.
Tim Brodribb is a professor of evolutionary plant physiology at the University of Tasmania in Hobart. More on those challenging ideas this week in Science Friction with Natasha Mitchell on RN and Peter Volleben, their guest. This is The Science Show on RN. Moving around a lot this week, yes, with planes and worries about emissions. But there are answers, as Peter Hadfield reports.
Sydney to Los Angeles in half the time it takes now. Well, before we get to the fun part of passengers whizzing round the world at supersonic speeds, there's the question of what this may mean for global warming. So first, let's take a look at the big theme of this year's Farnborough Air Show, sustainable aviation fuels, or SAFs.
The global mobility sector consumes around 1.7 billion tons of fuels, out of which 300 million tons have been consumed by the aviation industry. So there's a forecast that by 2050 there will be around 500 million tons of fuels consumed by 10,000 of aircraft globally. My name is Helge Sachs. I'm the Senior Vice President of Sasol EcoFT. FT stands for Fischer-Tropsch. Fischer-Tropsch is a technology that dates back to the 1920s already. I think everybody is now increasingly getting aware that there's no real alternative solution to decarbonize the aviation industry.
Fischer-Tropsch is a chemical reaction that combines simple carbon gases and hydrogen in the presence of a catalyst to make hydrocarbons and water. Every company I spoke to that's making synthetic fuel starts with the same Fischer-Tropsch reaction. But they're competing with how they can improve it. EcoFT, for example, has developed new types of catalysts to make the process more efficient. Another firm, founded just 2 years ago by Formula One legend Paddy Lowe, is using a technique that's more selective.
So I'm Paddy Lowe, I'm CEO and founder of Zero Petroleum. And the zero represents zero fossil. I worked 32 years in Formula One. I was at Mercedes, I was at Williams, and I was at McLaren. And I've always felt that sort of consuming something finite. The core of our process at the synthesis level is Fischer-Tropsch. So Fischer and Tropsch were two German chemists. They developed this science about 100 years ago. And it was used, in fact, in the Second World War by Germany to make fuels from coal. The ingredients are hydrogen and carbon monoxide in that case. We change it now in this new context. We have to work with carbon dioxide because that's the feedstock we take from the atmosphere, and hydrogen generated by electrolysis of water from renewable power. So it's in the feedstocks where we make this a fossil-free process. And then in the synthesis, because of the expense of generating those feedstocks, we don't want to waste any, so the Fischer-Tropsch has to be far more specialized, far higher grade than it was in the past. In Zero Petroleum, we have our own proprietary version of Fischer-Tropsch, and the unique features of that are that it's very, very specific in the range of carbon molecules it makes, particularly around length. So if we want gasoline, we make gasoline. If we want jet fuel, we make jet fuel, rather than a sort of wide spectrum.
I met Paddy at the Zero Petroleum stand where his company had parked a single-seat aeroplane that's an important milestone, the world's first plane propelled entirely by synthetic fuel, as recognised by the Guinness Book of Records.
So this aircraft flew on 2nd of November 2021, the first flight powered by synthetic fuel. We were proving a point, demonstrating that effectively we have a formula that this can be done. You know, people don't believe stuff till they see it actually done. We were showing what can be done, and the very, very important point here is to achieve it as a drop-in. We made fuel that went straight in the tank, no modification to the engine whatsoever. and delivered exactly the same power measured on the rig as the normal fossil fuel.
It's about time. Time to turn the past into the present. Overture.
Which brings us to the world's next supersonic plane, Overture. The sustainable fuel revolution is happening at a time when planes are about to get a lot faster and a lot more thirsty for fuel. Overture, built by an American company called Boom Supersonic, will be the world's first supersonic passenger jet since Concorde. And with aircraft already responsible for 2.5% of all the CO2 we pump into the atmosphere, the only way to make that kind of travel feasible is to make it sustainable.
My name is Ben Murphy. I'm head of sustainability here at Boom Supersonic. We expect that every time that you increase speed of travel, you're going to see more travel. But we recognize that if supersonic travel does result in that increase that we expect it will, that has to be done sustainably as well. And so we launched an initiative called the Sustainable Travel Forum, which is bringing together thought leaders from across industries, including electric vehicle charging, all the way to tourist organizations like Visit Britain or the Australian tour organizations, to really think about ways that we can act now to innovate, educate, and advocate for sustainable travel and tourism across the entire journey beyond just decarbonizing aviation.
Ben Murphy says the supersonic Overture could get the carbon for its fuel from some unusual sources.
Municipal solid waste, so turning trash into fuel, so the parts of the plants that have no other use. You can also create sustainable aviation fuel through a process called power to liquid, sometimes called e-fuels or e-kerosene. And this is where you use renewable energy to pull carbon out of the air. Combine that with hydrogen, and that creates your jet fuel. And in that case, you can see that you very clearly close the carbon cycle. And for every atom of carbon that you're burning, you've previously pulled one atom of carbon out of the atmosphere.
What was it that Concorde got wrong that you guys got right?
Sure, the Concorde was a technological marvel. It was well ahead of its time. In the 60 years that have progressed since then, advances in jet engine technology, going from afterburning turbojets to modern medium bypass turbofan engines, helped to reduce fuel consumption. The advances in composite materials made a huge difference in terms of lighter weight materials. Also something called area ruling.
Could you explain what that is?
Yeah, so when you're going supersonically, you introduce a new kind of drag that you don't have subsonically called wave drag. This is drag that's produced when you break the sound barrier. You can think about it sort of in its simplest way as you're almost pushing the air out of the way and forcing it to compress. And you're compressing it so much that it produces that sonic boom. So as the wing starts to grow with the delta wing area, if you think about it, you're looking at it from the front, cutting slices down the length of the aircraft, the wing area increases. And so in order to keep your total cross-sectional area constant, you have to reduce your fuselage area as your wing grows. And so that concept of area ruling, getting narrower with the largest part of the wing, really helps to reduce wave drag and ultimately improve performance of the vehicle, reducing fuel burn.
Now, I understand that the cost of this is not going to be as much. I mean, cost per the passenger is not going to be as much as it was for Concorde. You're looking at basically business class or first class fares, which is remarkable. Do you see the day coming when this kind of plane will be normal for very long haul flights, that you take a supersonic instead of a subsonic plane?
I sure hope so. Having flown across the Atlantic over Saturday night, I would have loved if that trip was half the time. Right now, because of all of those technology innovations since the Concorde, we are projecting prices as much as 75% lower than the Concorde ticket price. The Concorde was up to $20,000 in 2019 dollars, and that's just not feasible for most people to fly. It was sort of a luxury item or a bucket list. And that's not the future we want. We want the future where everybody can fly supersonically. So this first product is targeting business class fares. And we think that with those technology developments, that's very possible.
So at the moment, we're basically halving the time it would take to go from Sydney to Los Angeles. And hopefully in the future, you might see the same coming to Europe.
Yeah, you're having with just a quick tech stop, so that's why it's not quite exactly one half. Beyond that, yes, we hope to bump up the range. We're able to fly twice as fast over water and about 20% faster over land, targeting about Mach 0.94 for overland flight.
Is that because of the noise issue?
Yeah, supersonic flight, as I described earlier, you end up with that air compression as you're flying through the air, and that is ultimately what generates a sonic boom. That boom is continuous as you're flying at supersonic speeds and is loud enough to reach the land. Right now, overland supersonic flight is prohibited nearly around the world, but there are emerging technologies that are showing that you can end up with a much quieter boom. The X-59 program being developed by NASA and Lockheed Martin. We'll aim to test that over the next few years, testing their low boom technology, what they call a quiet thump, more akin to closing a car door than a cracking firework.
United Airlines has already ordered 15 Overtures, and Japan Airlines has an option to buy 20. The first commercial flight is scheduled for 2029. But the United Airlines deal is contingent on the Overture running on 100% sustainable fuel. The airline has to keep to that commitment, and Boom Supersonic has to make the fuel system work for the dream to become reality. But if they get it right, and passengers insist that they do get it right, some of us could be whizzing round the world at supersonic speeds without having to feel guilty about the amount of fuel we're consuming. For The Science Show, I'm Peter Hadfield in Farnborough.
And thank you, Peter. Now, as we turn to Royal Societies, ours and theirs, it just so happens that Dr. Susan Pond, our Society President, among her manifold abilities and appointments, nuclear, gene shears, and with Johnson & Johnson, worked on new biofuels for planes, and she even helped pioneer their use. Here she is to celebrate the Society's 200th.
My name is Susan Pond, and I'm President of the Royal Society of New South Wales.
And you have a medical background, do you not?
I do. I graduated in medicine from the University of Sydney way back when. So I was at the University of Queensland in the Department of Medicine for 12 years, a large family.
How do you manage all that?
Well, the most interesting thing towards the end of my 12 years there at the University of Queensland was the fact that I was chair of the Australian Drug Evaluation Committee for the Therapeutic Goods Administration. I loved it because it was the cutting edge of the emergence of new therapies, and in particular, the ones based on recombinant DNA. And I wasn't in a box in my career path of genomics and genetics.
Well, that's just the sort of thing you need to be president of the New South Wales Royal Society. Now, we're here to celebrate the fact that it's just been your 200th birthday. You gave the most fantastic dinner, 300 people, the cream of Australian science, all through the Great Hall of the University of Sydney, and it was name-drop heaven. I don't know how you did it.
The Society's, as you say, been around for 200 years, but of course, over that time, it's had enormous interactions across Australia, across the Southern Hemisphere, and internationally. It is the oldest learned society in the Southern Hemisphere, and it traces its origins back to 1821. So it's got a rich history, and in order to put the dinner on, of course, you can imagine the work involved in delving into that rich history and making the connections, putting on an exhibition, which we did at the State Library of New South Wales, which was very well attended.
You might just ask you, this is long before the establishment of our first university. The
yes,
University of Sydney was about 1850-something.
Yes.
Why did they want to have a learned society in a country whose European associations were just so young?
Well, interestingly, two of the main proponents who founded what was then called the Australian Philosophical Society, and that was founded back in 1821 by two medical practitioners. There was a group of about 10 of them who wanted to bring intellectual and cultural life to the new colony. And Governor Brisbane, who arrived in Sydney in 1821, became the first president of the
Society. He was an astronomer, wasn't he?
He was an astronomer.
Thomas Brisbane.
Yes, so the small group realised the importance of discovery and science to the future of Australia. And of course, there are all sorts of discoveries to be made in the flora, the fauna, the astronomy, which is a very heavy focus, and geology was another very heavy focus. Agriculture.
The oldest institution of science in Australia is the Royal Botanic Gardens, which was opened in 1816. And, of course, then the Australian Museum as 1827, which is the year Beethoven died. That's how you remember it, of course. Yeah. But that's 1821, is pretty good.
It's pretty good. And so the University of Sydney was really pushed by Henry Grattan Douglas, who seems to have been a very colourful character, but forceful. And he persuaded Wentworth, and Nicholson was involved in the foundation of the University of Sydney. And it was founded in the 1850s. Grattan Douglas has a coat of arms etched in stone and a stained glass window dedicated to him in the Great Hall when it was built. So many of the founders of the society and members of the society were the ones who were instrumental in realising that New South Wales needed a university. And the university was founded about the same time that New South Wales itself formed a parliament.
Leaping towards this century, as you did in your wonderful speech, the one before Alan Finkel, the former chief scientist who succeeded you actually at the dinner, you talked about the more recent achievements. You can't list them all, but give us a flavour of some of them.
So some of the areas that I recounted were the post-war, back in the early 1900s. The society was instrumental in forming the forerunner to the Australian Academy of Science, the Australian National Research Council, which the society helped to form back in the 1920s. Eventually, that was disbanded in 1954 when the Australian Academy of Science was born. The same set of people was involved in the foundation of what was then CSIR, which is now CSIRO. The next thing I talked about in my speech was the grant to the society by the New South Wales government of the land to build Science House, which is in the Rocks in Sydney. And this was granted in the 1920s, and the society and the Institution of Engineers and the Linnaean Society built that building at their own expense and occupied it until the early 1970s.
Now, you know, Madam President, that the ABC is a very, very left-wing organisation, and we have to celebrate such things whenever we're doing an interview. And what I'd like to mention, Science House, which you described, was going to be taken away, was going to be pulled down, but you are protected by the Green Bands, by Jack Mundey, who was then leader of the Builders Labourers, you know, with their green attitude, and they saved Science House. Unfortunately, you're no longer in it, but the building's still there.
The beautiful building is still there, and if anyone's interested, they should go in, because the seal of the society is there, etched into one of the glass doors. It's beautiful. But you're right, the Askin government wanted to, in the 70s, reclaim the Rocks for redevelopment. So they resumed Science House, amongst others. And it was Jack Mundey and his builders, labourers and others who saved the Rocks, but they could not save the society. By that time, we'd been kicked out and remain out.
So you're homeless?
We're homeless.
Oh, dear.
Except that we do occupy, with the gracious support of the State Library of New South Wales, the Jean Garling Room in the State Library, where we keep our precious collection of books, and we have our archives in the State Library archives. We don't have offices or meeting rooms or premises that we can call our own, though.
But you've got a wonderful history of having had such an influence on the culture, the scientific culture and the intellectual culture of Australia. Congratulations on your 200th, and good luck following Alan Finkel's example for the future.
Thank you.
Dr. Susan Pond, President of the Royal Society of New South Wales, and happy 200th. Across the globe, another highly experienced science leader, Dr. Julie Maxton, is CEO of the Royal Society of London. And as we once more promote our superstars of STEM, do they, like some gold-medalled athletes, encourage or put off youngsters who doubt that they themselves can manage such glory? Julie Maxton.
I think it's important to have some superstars, but actually I think you have to have others who are also role models who are much closer to achieving a modest goal than the superstars. If you're in school, the idea of being a superstar is too far away from you. How about looking at the people who are achieving by finishing their PhDs and then looking forward from there?
But that also looks at a fairly conventional rise through the academic system. What if you really want to do science as part of life rather than to become a professor in 20 years' time? How would you persuade a young, say, teenage group at school that science is important for them, whatever they do?
I would get along some really innovative companies, the emergent sort of Bill Gates, who dropped out of university, people like that, who are fascinated by technology, fascinated by its applications, but who are just starting out, who haven't sold their companies, who've got great ideas and are passionate and enthusiastic. And it might be a gaming company, who knows, but it will resonate with the kids who play Roblox or any of these other games.
And what sort of things are you doing along those lines here at the Royal Society across Britain and beyond?
We try and bring together young innovators, young people at schools. We have a schools program where we work with the schools and we show them and inspire them about science. And at the moment, we have a summer science exhibition going on. We've got a schools room where we have enthusiastic school students who are very confident in talking about science, very delighted to do it, and they're meeting a range of scientists, from people who are just starting out with innovations through to fellows of the Royal Society who are practically at the other end of the spectrum, if I may say.
Yes, it's going on right now, and you've got everything from the science of chocolate and how fermentation is a key to making better chocolate. You've got a display for neuroscientists. What happens if you have an artificial thumb attached to your hand, and how will your nervous system apply to that? What about the future of fusion power, which we're always talking about? You know, the cliche, it's always 30 years ahead and always will be. So you've got this wonderful range of young people, and I've seen them as explainers, if you like, as you might get in science centres with visitors coming in. Is that working well?
It's working very well. I mean, one of the key themes of our strategy is, we call it science and society. So we need to get into society, not just stick in London, but get out across the country, get out internationally, working with the same messages as I think you're promoting in Australia. And it's working very well. I mean, all of the exhibitors in our exhibition have come through a rigorous selection process. And that's why you get such a variety of topics. Well, I'm very confident in the future of science in the schools in the UK and in young people going into science, using science in a very general way, not just traditionally into universities, etc., but into innovation, adaptation, etc.
As I walk around your exhibition, I see, well, virtually everybody, young, old. Does that just happen, or did you select carefully to make that achievable?
I think the UK is a very diverse country today. We just selected the schools on the strength of their science, but there are people of all backgrounds in the schools. So it's no surprise to me. I had no idea who would be turning up from the schools. But I agree with you. There's a complete range of people from all backgrounds in the building. But let me say that increasing diversity in STEM is one of the key principles, again, of our strategy. It has been for a long time and it will be into the future. We have some targeted programs going on, but it is important to the Royal Society also, not only for the breadth of STEM to be as wide as possible, and we want to remove barriers to success in STEM, but we're very conscious that the fellowship of the Royal Society isn't as diverse as it could be. Women were only admitted in 1945, and it had been going for 300 years at that point, and then only two of them were admitted. And at the moment, the percentage of women stands at around 10%. So there's clearly work to be done, and we are doing it, which is another of the themes of our strategy, which is increasing diversity in the fellowship. So we're starting work on that.
And never a president, Royal Society.
in 300 years as a woman. Next door, of course, you've got the Royal Academy of Engineering and a brilliant aviation professor from Cambridge. She was in charge of inventing the silent aircraft, I think it was. And so Australia's had more than one, maybe even three presidents. So soon, you say?
Well, this president we have at the moment has been in just about 18 months, and the president serves a 5-year term. We are conscious that there's never been in the history of the Royal Society a female president, and I'm confident that there will be interest from many female FRSs to take on the presidency. I think it will send a good message to the community, and it will be one of your superstars, if you like, but I would never say that everybody could be the president of the Royal Society, but I think it'll be quite a good message.
Yeah. Now, there are Royal Societies around the world, in New Zealand and, of course, in Australia, the Commonwealth, and our own New South Wales, the original Royal Society, had its 200th birthday just 2 or 3 weeks ago, and it was absolutely packed with so many of our brilliant scientists. I think there was standing room only in some parts, which is a bit of a shock, because it's always been sort of like a quiet, private debating group if you're a casual onlooker and don't actually know what's going on. Do you have a direct relationship with these societies? Do you work with Australia at all?
We do work with Australia. We work with the Australian Academy of Science, which the CEO there is a very good friend, Anna Maria Arabia. And Andrew Holmes, a former president, actually was here at the exhibition yesterday with his wife, Jenny. We do work with them where it makes sense to work with them. And for example, with the Australian Academy of Science, we had great work together on climate change a few years ago. We're always willing to work with any society, whether it's named the Royal Society or not, where we have the same messages. And the global challenges of climate change, biodiversity, data, they're challenges that we all face. And I think it would be naive to think that any one of us could overcome them. We need to be better together. And I think that means joining up on our messages and our work and our influencing, which is again a theme of our strategy.
I was just reading in the news today, I'm talking at the time when the floods, the recent floods in Sydney and environs are gigantic. And there had been comments from the scientists about what was going on. And yet, on the internet, there was a suggestion that someone was making it happen by cloud seeding, you know, this conspiracy theory. And it's got legs. What do you do about such misinformation?
Well, I think that's one of the biggest challenges of our time, is misinformation. And working together with other scientific bodies gives us a chance to become known as a trusted source of scientific information. We have to look for evidence, stick to facts. The motto of the Royal Society is nullius in verba, which loosely translated means take nobody's word for it. In other words, find out for yourself what the facts are. And I think that the internet is capable of facilitating, as are other platforms, all kinds of misinformation. I think what we have to teach our young people to do is to concentrate on finding out for themselves, not just grasping at straws in the wind, which may be untrue or misinformation of one sort or another. I think we've got to press the message, the scientific method, do the experiment, work out for yourself what the facts are, and stick to them. And I think we've got to press it all the time.
With a little help from the science teachers as well.
We always want help from the science teachers. We always want to help the science teachers in any way we can. But people like Brian Cox, who's our professor of public engagement, we have him doing experiments that we film and give out to schools. And for example, if the experiment goes wrong, we keep the camera running, because that's a learning point too. So I think it's really, really important that we stress to people, don't just hear something secondhand. Find out what the facts are, and then you speak from a position of real authority.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Julie Maxton from New Zealand, now CEO of the Royal Society of London. And it's interesting that most of our Australian academies of health, science, technology, the humanities, all have women as CEOs. Next week, The Science Show goes back to Scotland to explore the evolution of mammals with the brilliant Steve Brossatti.
Production by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams, and my favourite tree is the Tree of Knowledge. Have an apple.
Ah, thanks, Robin.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.